The Tom Woods Show, episode 735.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hello and welcome to another week of The Tom Woods Show. I've got a bit of a potpourri episode here for you, just because I have a bunch of things that have been showing up in my social media feeds that I feel like commenting on, and my gosh, do I spend too much time on Twitter, so I think it's better just get it off my chest on the show and then never discuss it again. But before I do that, I just cannot, for some reason, I can't stop watching that video. This is September 12th, 2016, that video of Hillary Clinton trying to get into that van. There's something extremely disturbing about that video, where she's having the so-called medical episode. And this is because she had pneumonia. I can't quite put my finger on exactly what's the creepiest part of that video. It could be all the Secret Service people getting into position to obscure our view of what's happening and serve no other purpose. It could be that. But for me, it's something that nobody's commented on. It's that when she's standing there leaning up against whatever that pole is, she's standing there being propped up, and her head does not move an inch. Now, if I were basically on the verge of death, so ill that I had to leave an event that if I leave it, it's going to cause tremendous damage to me politically. If I'm feeling that bad, I'm going to be, even if maybe, you know, in whispered tones, I'm going to be looking around at the people around me saying, oh, gosh, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. This is really rough, or something. You know, just do something. Her head does not move an inch. It doesn't move at all. There's no acknowledgement of anybody around her. There's no small talk. There's no, oh, I hope this van comes soon. I really, really need to sit down. Or there's nothing. But yet at the same time, if she were unconscious, presumably she wouldn't be able to hold her head up. So I don't know what's going on, but something is extremely fishy about the whole thing. And might I add, by the way, that I am an unabashed pickle jar truther. That whole thing on Jimmy Kimmel where he brings out the pickle jar and she opens it semi-effortlessly. Now, it's true, Alex Jones did a segment on that, and then Jimmy Kimmel made fun of him for it. But he made fun of him, I think, because Alex Jones was obviously correct. On that issue, Alex Jones was obviously correct. Nobody opens a pickle jar like that, where you just keep on turning right through the pop. Now, the pop stops you, at least temporarily, and then you continue on. Nobody opens a pickle jar the way she did. But secondly, how utterly naive about the way modern politics works would you have to be to think that a campaign, particularly one beset by health rumors as Clinton's is, would leave something like that to chance? You're telling me they would not rig that jar? Look, I know for a fact through my own personal experiences how presidential campaigns and political campaigns work. They do not leave anything to chance. If you're going to talk to the candidate, interview the candidate, do anything related to the candidate, your questions are going to be vetted. There are going to be certain things that are off limits. You're not allowed to talk about. You think you're just going to be allowed to just arbitrarily produce a pickle jar to test the candidate's strength? That is not going to happen. So anyway, I mean, I don't know anything more than this. I don't know anything more than the pickle jar was obviously a hoax. I mean, that is just so obvious, it's not even debatable. And secondly, something really weird and fishy is going on with Hillary Clinton. See, it's just this kind of breathtaking insight that you tune in to the Tom Woods Show for. All right, what do I want to talk about today? I kind of want to talk about the left as a bunch of liars. And I guess I need to preface this by saying that I know there are a lot of right-wing liars. I spend a lot of time on the show dealing with them. Many, many episodes dealing with right-wing liars, particularly with people who lie when it comes to foreign policy. Lot of liars there. So no, I'm the last person in the world you need to talk to assure that there are right-wing liars. I'm well aware of them. I wouldn't say I used to be one. I was more of a deluded, brainwashed right-winger than a liar. I really did not think of myself as a liar. I think the people, the architects of the policies that I inadvertently said misleading things about were liars. But I think a lot of the people who follow along just, well, that's their instinct. They know you defend the military, and that's as far as it goes. That doesn't defend them. You have the obligation to inform yourself about important things you're talking about, especially when human life is at stake. But I think the real liars are the ones pulling the strings in that case. Now, I don't want to go too easy on them. There are plenty of them who really, frankly, couldn't care less what the truth is. It's just USA, USA. I've had a lot of that. And I have had people say, if it's a war in which the U.S. is a participant, then the U.S. is obviously correct and always correct. I have been told that. And that is a kind of lie. That's a willful refusal to examine facts. So please do not think I have gone soft. But on the other hand, I have a special place in my heart, the hatred part. That's not really hatred. You know, I just get frustrated at injustice. That's what we're talking about here. In my heart for the left. For some reason, the left just drives me up a wall. I personally believe they are the threat to civilization. I am open to have a friendly discussion of that topic. But I remember, and forgive me if I've told you this story before, but when you've done 735 episodes, it's hard to remember which things you've covered and which ones you haven't. But I remember back in my freshman or sophomore year, must have been sophomore year in college, I took a course in colonial America with a professor, and I better not say his name because it was an off-the-record dinner conversation. I mean, we're talking over 20 years ago at this point. I don't think he's even in academia anymore, actually. But this was a brilliant guy, and he was basically center-left, as a lot of Harvard professors were. But I liked him because he was rigorous, he was smart, he was interesting. And so anyway, they a couple of times a year, they have a special dinner where you can invite a faculty member to dinner. And I did that several times. And one time I invited this guy. And we got to the dinner, and what I remember the most about it is we were talking about political views, and I figured, what the heck, I'm inviting this guy to dinner, I think I'll tell him what my political views are. So I did, it was no problem. And he said, you know, in my experience as a scholar, I would say that the right tends to be more scrupulous with the facts than the left. Now, how about that? How about that? And basically, that has been more or less my experience. I feel like a lot of times what's going on is that the left is using current events and statistics that they will play with as a means of policy advocacy. So that is to say, they'll make, for example, I'll give you a perfect example of this. Mitch Snyder, now if you were raised in the 80s like I was, you may remember his name. Mitch Snyder was a homeless advocate, and he is the source. Now, we don't hear that much about the homeless for some reason these days, but in the 80s, the homeless, that was a big, big issue. It was talked about a lot, and we were told that there were 3 million homeless people, and people just accepted this figure, 3 million homeless. It's quite an enormous number when you stop and think about it. 3 million people? 3 million homeless people? It's not impossible. It just seems extremely implausible. But all right, that was the figure we were given. Well, very few people bothered to ask, where did we get that figure? Did they go out and do field research? And did they try to seek out the homeless? And did they extrapolate from the numbers and reach 3 million? Or how did it come about? The answer was Mitch Snyder made that number up. He invented that number, and he was open about it. When he was asked about it, he later said, I didn't do any studies. I just picked a number that I thought would get attention. He just flat out said that. That's what I mean about taking numbers, or in this case, manufacturing a number, for the purpose of pushing a particular policy that you want, getting attention for the homeless situation, getting policies in force to fight against homelessness, whatever it is. They use facts or they invent facts in order to push the policies they want. I see that much, much more with the left than I do with the right. Now, on the other hand, I will say that, for instance, when it comes to sometimes gun rights and sometimes when it comes to banking and the Federal Reserve, I will find the right is extremely careless when it comes to quoting the Founding Fathers. The left doesn't quote the Founding Fathers because they couldn't care less about them. But the right does care about the Founding Fathers. There is still that lingering idea of tradition as being part of conservatism and being true to the original Constitution and all that. Well, the right, I find, is extremely careless in repeating what should be obviously fake quotations from the Founding Fathers. My slogan when it comes to quotations from the Founding Fathers is, if it sounds like it could have been said yesterday, it probably was. So there's that Thomas Jefferson quotation, alleged Thomas Jefferson quotation that goes around all over the place. I believe that banking institutions are more dangerous to our liberties than standing armies. If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issue of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and corporations that will grow up around these banks will deprive the people of all property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered. So we hear this a lot. That's a phony quotation. So if you've been guilty of spreading that one around, you got to cut that out. There's nothing to that whatsoever. There's nothing to that. And it's, by the way, it tends to be the greenbacker anti-Fed people who like that quotation because they hate the idea that private banks might control the issue of the currency. But why would we object to that? We're libertarians. I have no problem with a private bank issuing a note, and if somebody wants to accept it, that's fine. I have no problem with that. In a genuinely free economy, what's the matter? If you don't want it, then don't accept it. Big deal. So that's not an issue to us, but that one is everywhere. That was not said by Jefferson, that period. And you can tell that from clues, by the way, linguistic clues, like deflation. I'm pretty sure that term was not even used in the 19th century. So again, if it sounds like it could have been written yesterday, it probably was. Same with guns. There are a lot of phony quotations from the Founding Fathers about guns. There are enough good ones. I don't see why people have to rely on the phony ones. And Jefferson had some really great sound money quotations, which is why the greenbackers don't ever use those, because Jefferson basically favored precious metals. He favored a scheme whereby the paper money would be handed over and exchanged for gold and silver coins, and those would circulate, and we would get rid of the paper. We would retire the paper. Well, no greenbacker wants to hear that, so we don't hear that. Anyway, That was a really long, long digression. All right, so I was talking about Mitch Snyder and the homeless and just making the number up. Or let's take, for example, the old Gloria Steinem quotation. Again, this is back in the 80s, this would have been, I think. I'm pretty sure it was when I was growing up. It could have been in the 90s. I'm just thinking about things in my own life that I recall. But it was somewhere around then. I don't know. It could have been more recent. Who knows? You can Google it. Gloria Steinem said that 100,000 women per year are dying from anorexia. 100,000 women. So what's the point of that exaggeration? Why is she saying that? Well, of course, it's to show that the patriarchal standard of beauty that oppresses women actually kills them. And so, therefore, it'd be better if we not insist on people trying to conform to a standard of beauty. Well, it turns out that the actual number of women who die every year from anorexia is fewer than 100. Now, I don't mean fewer than 100,000. I mean fewer than 100. I mean like in the double digits. Not to say that that's not tragic, but it's not 100,000. Now, of course, we could go into all kinds of crazy things they say on college campuses, like the rape statistics that we hear about the number of women who are assaulted on campus. These are not believable. I did an episode with Wendy McElroy. Let me write that down. As a related episode, I'll put on the show notes page, obviously tomwoods.com/735, on that whole the rape culture thing. You know, it's funny that today on the environment, the left acts as if the right is just anti-science and they just refuse to listen to reason, whereas the left, as usual, is just coolly surveying the data. But that's certainly not been generally my experience. Certainly beginning in the 80s, when I became politically aware, it looked like the left exaggerated or invented basically everything it was talking about related to the environment, and that goes all the way back to DDT, which was well before I was born. In the early 1960s, Rachel Carson wrote that book, Silent Spring. She's worried that DDT, which was a pesticide, it was going to kill off the birds and it was going to give everybody cancer. Now, it turns out that this is not, in fact, the case. And I'm looking at a book right now called The Creative Society, How the Future Can Be Won. And what I read here is that clinical trials were conducted by the U.S. Public Health Service in which human volunteers ate up to 35 milligrams of DDT every day for 18 months, approximately 1,000 times as much as people would normally be exposed to. No adverse effects could be observed during the test period or over the next 10 years where they were still checked. The workers in the DDT-producing Montrose Chemical Company operated without any protective clothing and had for years inhaled so much DDT dust that it amounted, in one case, to what a normal person would experience in 1,300 years. And yet, as a study of them by the American Medical Association concluded, it is noteworthy that after 10 to 20 years on the job, no cases of cancer developed among these workers in some 1,300 man-years of exposure, a statistically improbable event. Professor J. Gordon Edwards was a well-known expert on the toxicity of DDT. He was at San Jose State University, and he used to start his lectures on the subject by eating a spoonful of it right in front of the class, and he would do so in the media as well. And he eventually died at the age of 84 in the year 2004. He died of a heart attack while climbing a mountain. It also turns out that the bird population increased fairly substantially as a result of DDT. Now, these were the sorts of facts that nobody talked about because they weren't fashionable. Well, then the attention shifted to DDT in seawater, what the effects that that could have. So Charles Worster, in 1968, he became co-founder of the Environmental Defense Fund. In 1968, he showed, and now I'm going to, again, just note to you from this book, that a resolution of 500 parts per million DDT in seawater reduced plankton photosynthesis. Well, that sounded very worrying until people pointed out that you actually cannot dissolve that much DDT in seawater. It saturates at 1.2 parts per million. In addition, they also noted that the actual concentrations of DDT in the oceans were less than 0.1% of the lowest concentration he had tested, and that his tests had shown that concentrations below the 1.2 parts per million saturation actually had been beneficial for photosynthesis. But how had he made a maximum concentration that was 400 times the saturation point? He had dissolved large amounts of alcohol in the salt water, so that the concentration of DDT could be brought up to 400 times the natural saturation point. To replicate this in nature, one would have to turn the world's oceans into alcoholic drinks and then mix in approximately 660 cubic kilometers of DDT. And then you would have to keep mixing more in rather frantically because tests conducted at the EPA's Gulf Breeze Laboratory in Louisiana showed that 92% of the DDT disappeared from the seawater within 38 days. In 1970, the American Academy of Sciences published a report in which they argued that DDT used for malaria had probably already saved the lives of some 500 million people worldwide. Therefore, they pointed out, banning the use of this substance would lead to millions of deaths and disablings, and it would also induce people to fight malaria with other, more toxic agents. The following year, the Environmental Protection Agency in the U.S. staged a 7-month-long consultation in which 125 experts and 365 papers on the effects of DDT were presented to a judge. After this investigation and examination of witnesses, the judge concluded that DDT was beneficial, harmless, and should remain legal. However, the environmentalists ignored all of this and kept up their political pressure, after which use of DDT was banned via a combination of laws and international political pressure tactics. And then, skipping ahead, The consequence of the banning of DDT was that an unknown number of millions of people who could have been saved through the use of DDT became ill or died of malaria. How many exactly is impossible to say, but if the previous estimate that DDT had saved 500 million people before the ban was realistic, the number of deaths caused by this ban has been the greatest man-made disaster ever. On 15th September 2006, the nightmare finally ended when the UN issued a press release stating, "Nearly 30 years after safety concerns led to the phasing out of indoor spraying with DDT and other insecticides to control malaria, the United Nations Health Agency said today it will start promoting this method again to fight the global scourge that kills more than 1 million people every year, including around 3,000 children every day." Now, the environmental stuff could go on and on and on, but that gives you a flavor of some of it. Then I remember, and again, I'm sorry if I've told you this before, but maybe some people haven't heard it. When I was in college, I started getting some of the Media Research Center stuff, and they were like a watchdog group that would keep an eye on the media. There was a study that was being touted by Dan Rather as showing that something like 12 to 16 million American children were, quote, starving. Not a little bit hungry, not unable to get a dessert, but starving. I thought, how could somebody repeat such a preposterous thing that defies everyday experience? 16 million people are starving? Well, it turns out when you go back and look at the study actually consisted of asking a bunch of children the question, did you go to bed hungry at any time during the year 1991? And if the child said yes, then the media reported him as starving. So you see what I mean? The manipulation of data for the purposes of policy advocacy, right? Now, this is meant to make government look like a benign force we couldn't live without, make families look pathetic and helpless and backward. I mean, it fits into the narrative that they're trying to push. Now, you know what? I think it was Michael Bolden of the 10th Amendment Center. Michael Bolden sent me a link to an article on a left-wing site, might be Alternet, and it's Ralph Nader congratulating himself on the traffic safety laws that he helped get signed into law back in 1966, so 50 years ago. So the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration is given credit for having reduced the rate of fatalities, highway fatalities. This article, by the way, is called "Federal Regulation Saves Millions of Lives." Okay, so he's looking at the number of deaths per 100 million vehicle miles traveled. He's comparing it 1966 to 2014. There's obviously been a decline, and he gives the credit for this to this government agency. And he says, you know, millions of lives have been saved. But this is absolutely typical of, again, how the left operates. It has to show that we can't live without the state. There are no other alternatives. There are no other ways we might promote safety in the absence of the state that we're not doing now, but that we would do in the absence of the state, not to mention things we are doing now, even with the state. All this is left out, and the way they do it, as I've mentioned before, is they simply leave out what was happening previously. They just look at a number in one year, a number in another year. The second number is lower. They say the government program is responsible for the number being lower. What they don't look at is what was happening before that first year. So 1966 to 2014. What was happening before 1966? What was the trend in fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled? What was the trend there? The percentage decline in fatalities was exactly the same before the creation of the National Traffic and National Highway Traffic Safety Administration was created as it was afterward. Exactly the same. Well, that is rather a relevant fact, isn't it? You won't find it anywhere in Ralph Nader's article. Now, Ralph Nader's been a guest on the show, by the way, so maybe I'll put that down as a related episode. Ralph Nader. There, I was just being nice, because I was just so thrilled that he came on. So we talked about left-right stuff and war and all that. So, you know, if you're looking for me to smack them down on regulation, I chickened out. Okay, I'll just be honest with you. Now, I will link, let's see, I'm going to jot this down also. Link to Peltzman. I'm going to link to an article that that chronicles this and other things and shows you and talks about this fact, about where the trend was already going in this area. So if you ever need to back that up, I'll have a link for you at tomwoods.com/735. Then another form of error that I come across on the left is the false choice. And this happened recently in a dispute I got on Twitter, I got into on Twitter, on child labor. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, my Twitter handle is Thomas E. Woods. And somebody was going on about child labor, and thank goodness we had people who passed laws against it. And I said, look, all the laws in the world are not going to prevent a family from trying to keep their family members from starving to death. That's why you have child labor in the world. It's not because capitalism came along and created it. Child labor has existed since the beginning of the world. So the key thing is making the family wealthy enough that it can afford to keep the kids at home without starving. That's the point. So I pointed out the old the study by Oxfam, the British charity, that found that when Bangladesh caved in to Western demands on child labor, it wasn't that the children went to school the next day. Of course not. How could that possibly happen? The kids either went into prostitution or starved to death. Nice going, geniuses. 5 minutes of thinking about the likely consequences would have stopped this. But at least people like my Twitter opponent can feel better about themselves, and they've signaled to the world how superior they are. That's more important than the actual lives of the children. So that's the deal. Even the International Labor Organization, which is a left-wing organization, has come out and said, look, the reason that there is child labor in the world is that you have very, very poor countries, and the family won't survive unless the kids work. That is the brutal reality of the situation. But as capitalism develops and abundance grows, they no longer need to do that. So when you get these laws getting rid of child labor, they come about long after most of the existing child labor has been eradicated. And then they have their law and they congratulate themselves. But without the wealth, what would you like these children to do? And yet on Twitter, the choice was presented as, well, I would rather see them go to school. Well, I mean, look, I'd rather see them do anything in the world except be working in a factory. But there are a couple things I would less like to see: having them be prostitutes or having them be dead. So I would say child labor is my third to worst option for them. But sometimes when your only other options are the second to worst and the worst, the third to worst looks okay. So that was my point. So it's the false choice. Then the minimum wage. Oh my goodness gracious. We had somebody in my private Facebook group who posted a Twitter exchange that he had on the minimum wage with a Bernie supporter. And she's all for the $15 minimum wage, and he's saying, well, you know, that, because she's saying the $15 minimum wage will guarantee that everybody gets a job paying at least $15 an hour. And he said it doesn't guarantee anything. It's actually just an obstacle to people getting jobs. And she said, what? What's an obstacle to people getting jobs? He says, the $15 minimum wage. And she says, in effect, no, silly. Everybody who has a job will just get $15 and they'll get trained, you know, so they can survive. And I'm sorry to use the mocking voice, but at this point, what have we got left? So what's the deal there? If I were to say, I'm tired of people driving terrible cars on the road. That's a shame for them to have to drive such terrible cars. So I'm going to help them. I'm going to pass a law saying nobody can drive a car on the road that isn't worth at least $40,000. That will guarantee that everybody who drives a car will be driving a car that's worth at least $40,000. Yeah, that's true. But is that really the relevant question? I think the relevant question is how many people will be able to drive cars, period? How many people will be able to drive cars in the first place? Well, likewise, how many people will be able to get jobs in the first place for $15 an hour? Have you seen how many young people are have no skill whatsoever and are not useful for anything and are just surly and looking at their smartphones all day, you're going to tell me they're automatically worth $15 an hour plus being trained at that rate? So it's a false choice. It's the choice of, oh, well, the two choices are they will either work for $7.25 an hour or they'll work for $15 an hour. No, the correct choice is they work for $7.25 or they don't work. Now, there's a lot more we can say about the minimum wage, though, because people are going to want to know, well, oh, yeah, okay, Mr. Wise Guy, then how do we make people better off? I've covered that in a number of episodes, so I will link to those episodes at tomwoods.com/735 if you have an interest in that. Or the other kind of error is leaving out context. So this happens all the time when the left wants to prove discrimination, because it's assumed that everybody is of equal ability, and therefore if there are disparate outcomes, then the only explanation for this can be wickedness. So, for example, if Asians are earning, Asian PhDs earn more than black PhDs, well, that's a little uncomfortable for leftists because, well, then they would have to argue that there's a pro-Asian bias throughout the society, which would be kind of hard to account for. But nevertheless, that's what they'd have to conclude based on the logic of their thinking. There must be a pro-Asian, anti-black bias in the society. But of course, what you need to do is disaggregate the figures and ask, well, what are these PhDs in? Are we even comparing apples and apples? Are both groups majoring in engineering at the same rate? How many Asian PhDs are in education? I bet not a lot. And you don't get paid that much in education. So when you actually look at what field is the degree in, then the alleged scourge of discrimination against black PhDs simply disappears. But you won't hear that fact because it doesn't fit the narrative. The narrative is there to get the agenda pursued, which is more affirmative action, more government involvement, more intimidation of people, more trying to shut people up, more trying to get everybody to assume that racism is the explanation for everything. It's not. I will include my episode with Walter Williams when he was talking about this very subject. What the heck? Let's put both episodes that I've had Walter Williams on. Why not? Why not? Because he has a book called, I think it's called Race and Economics, How Much Can Discrimination Explain? Very interesting, where he actually bothers to bring in all the data that's relevant, not just one dangling piece of propaganda completely removed from context. Now, incidentally, when I created my government course for the Ron Paul homeschool curriculum, when I would cover a topic like child labor, I was careful to make these kinds of arguments, that it's not to say that we favor child labor. It's that a lot of the times people who would even have to consider child labor are in such desperate straits that the other options, if you can believe it, are even worse than the option that they've chosen. So what I try to do is show both sides, and that doesn't happen in a typical government course. Typical government course, it's taken for granted. We need the government to do the following things. Now let's go justify that statement. Whereas I don't start there. I think that's a lousy, dishonest, tendentious starting point. I start with, let's look at the question, and then let's consider that here's the traditional thing you'll hear in your government school, and here's another way of looking at it. And what I basically did in that course, which I guess it's now for 11th graders, they moved it up, but an adult could take this course and not in any way feel talked down to. That course is like a distillation of 20 years of learning on my part. So it's a semester course. You can listen to it in your car. You can watch it on your computer if you'd like to do that. But there are MP3s in it. And it is, it basically would save you 19 and a half years of nothing but study because I packed it all in there in this one semester course. So I do want to, I hope you won't mind if I just take one moment to distinguish between three websites I have, because it can get a little confusing. RonPaulHomeschool.com is my site for the Ron Paul curriculum, which is the K through 12 homeschool curriculum endorsed by Ron Paul that I think is the most important thing I've ever contributed to. It is an amazing, amazing thing what these kids learn. But RonPaulHomeschool.com is my site where if you join the curriculum through that site, you get $160 worth of free bonuses. You're not going to get that deal from anybody else. So ronpaulhomeschool.com. Second site is tomwoodshomeschool.com. This is where, suppose you want one of the courses I made for the Ron Paul curriculum, but you don't want to join the whole curriculum. Then you can get them at tomwoodshomeschool.com. That's where you can get that government course I just mentioned, at tomwoodshomeschool.com. Then finally, libertyclassroom.com, which you hear mentioned on the show a lot, is totally different from these. I created this long before there was a Ron Paul curriculum. And it's, although we've had plenty of homeschoolers who love it and used it successfully, I intended it primarily for adult enrichment, for people like, well, maybe you, the listener, who feel like I went through my education, I got a lot of propaganda, and now I'm sitting here with a piece of paper telling me I learned some stuff, and I'm not sure I did. And, you know, meanwhile, I'm getting crushed in debates by friends and family, even though I know I'm right, somehow I can't win. So the point of Liberty Classroom is to teach that stuff that wasn't taught to you in school, the real history, the real economics, philosophy, lots of great topics, great faculty, including Bob Murphy, Brian McClanahan, Kevin Gutzman, Brad Berzer, wonderful people who teach at that site. And you can listen to these courses on the go, so you don't even have to budget the time. So it's tremendous. So that's libertyclassroom.com. I'll link to all of this on today's show notes page, tomwoods.com/735. Now, let me update you on a couple of other things, show-related. A few things. First is, if you're listening to this week, I don't know why Bluehost is doing this. They're having another one of their flash sales. So don't start your website. Wait. Wait till Thursday the 15th. I think they're doing the 15th and the 16th of this week, which would be Thursday and Friday of this week, September 15th, 16th, 2016. They're offering hosting at $2.95 a month if you get it during one of those 2 days. That's incredible. So wait for that. Make sure you get my goodies when you get your hosting. So you got to use my link to get your hosting. Get lots of goodies. We have a tremendous blogger community, private group for people who use my link. Where just the other day, I had a question. I went into that group. Somebody else answered it for me. So we've got people, really knowledgeable people in there who are really going to help you. That's one of the perks. Join that group. Plus, I give you 24 tutorials. Plus, I give you a backlink on my site and a mention on the show. So get all the details on that at tomwoods.com/publicity. All right, schedule for this week. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so David Stockman from the Reagan administration, he's next week. So we're having him come on next week. I got Bill Kaufman coming back on, who's absolutely fantastic. And we've got that debate. It's going to be this Friday. So it's going to be, if all goes well, let's see, 6, 7, 8. So it would be episode 739 is going to be a debate on the founding of Israel, the creation of Israel, between two libertarians, whether or not the creation of Israel, of the modern state of Israel, was in conformity with libertarian principles or not. Now, whoa, that is going to be something you're going to want to sink your teeth into. That's going to be really juicy, great stuff. So look forward to that. And finally, let me tell you about something one of your fellow listeners is up to, and that is SolidusProject.com. Solidus, S-O-L-I-D-U-S, Project.com. This is a blog about money, but not about how to earn it. It's about, according to the About page, what money really is. Is it gold or silver? Is it pieces of paper with presidents' pictures on it? Is it numbers on a computer screen, checking account deposits, credit cards, whatever? What exactly is it? What do scholars in the past say about it? What have the ruling classes done to it? What's going on in the current news with regard to it? The goal of the project is to raise awareness about the need for honest money. A stable currency is the key to a nation's wealth, integrity, and liberty. It should be one of the central issues of our time. And it goes on to say, a currency that's manipulated by a central authority is the cause of many of society's ills. Declining standards of living, shrinking middle class, the growing wealth gap, recessions, and government's ability to spend without limit are just a few. So that's what's going to be covered over on this new blog, SolidusProject.com. So I will link to that, as the listener website mentioned, over at tomwoods.com/735, which is going to be a smorgasbord of goodies. So check that baby out, and we'll see you tomorrow.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.